Hello, everyone. Welcome to Lying to the Neighbors, Nasty Effects with Trackerless BitTorrent by Astro. Please give him a round of applause.
Good morning, everyone. Yeah, I call myself Astro, and I'm really keen on experimenting with network protocols and coding with them. And BitTorrent is really great. I make a lot of use of it. And one day I started reading on Trackerless BitTorrent, and there was one issue that caught my eye. And then I started experimenting, just as proof of concept. It looks like some of the information is already known to the BitTorrent developers, but information is rather scattered. They normally communicate over IRC, and there's a web forum on bittorrent.org where you can find some vague information on this. But I think this problem deserves more attention, and it's also an advice to anyone experimenting with distributed hash tables, especially with .p2p DNS on the horizon, like recently. Yes, recently we've had the AnonOps attacks, and I think DDoS, it's about denying information, so this is a form of censorship, and with great power comes great responsibility. Please do not do this in the event network here. We really value the liberal network policy, and it would be a really pity if the NOC had to introduce any filters before the packets hit the Wi-Fi. And also, please think of the kittens. So, I want to approach the topic by explaining why we need trackless BitTorrent and how BitTorrent works conventionally. You need to fetch a torrent first, a torrent file. It describes the data that is being exchanged between the peers. The peers are called the swarm. And once a client has the torrent file, it needs to do tracker requests. Trackers hold the peer addresses per torrent file. It's quite obvious that there are two single points of failure. The torrent indexes on the web and the trackers. The impact of a tracker failure is alleviated by an extension called torrent, called announce list, where you can put multiple trackers into a torrent file, but it's the central service. So one recurrent topic is B encoding or binary encoding, which is used for the BitTorrent extension protocol for DHT packets and, of course, for torrent files themselves. This is how a torrent file looks like. The data format has four types: integers, length, prefix, strings, lists, and dictionaries, and that's all. It's kind of like JSON, but it's binary safe. So in a torrent file, we usually find this structure. This is a screenshot of a gtorrent viewer, which is a nice graphical program to inspect torrent files. The significant part is the info hash. The whole torrent file is a dictionary. It has one specific key info, and this is being hashed, the binary encode value. and this is the so-called info hash. This complicates torrent parsers quite a bit. But the really nice thing here is we can modify the metadata, like the tracker address, or we can put some initial DHT nodes in there. And still, the info hash stays the same, so the torrent isn't modified. yes, the content, the actual content is described by this big pieces string, which contains just SHA1 sums of the individual pieces of the data that is being shared. So you can see BitTorrent is really only useful for static data, because if these if these piece hashes change, the whole info hash has changed. So one single point of failure are the indexes, and we don't want central indexes that can be taken down, like the Pirate Bay, which is still alive, but has been down already. A much more convenient method is a link form, which you can just pass around textually. Just remember the spread of the HD-DVD key. It was like, what was it? Maybe 64 bytes, which can be represented in hexadecimal, like in this magnet link, and can therefore be spread easily. Those magnet links have some parts. The first BTIH specifies that it's BitTorrent. Then follows the info hash that is the key for the data that is to be downloaded. Then follows a directory name, and you can give it a tracker address, but not necessarily. Yes, what we still need is a description of the data in the torrent. As you can see here, in these torrent files, there is a description what are the individual files, how big are they, what are their names. And if you use magnet links, you do tracker requests, you get peers, and then there's an extension where you can download the info value of the torrent file from another peer. And then you can finally start downloading. You only get the info value from other peers, but there's another extension for exchanging tracker addresses. So the other single point of failure are trackers. There are two solutions. Peer exchange works in the swarm that is individual for a torrent or info hash. And therefore, you need at least one peer, because it's data exchanged via peer-to-peer. So to start off, to download a torrent, you need another, you need other means to find peers. And there is this distributed hash table extension, which is globally, so it's not per info hash. And there's only, I think there's only one DHT, or one big DHT worldwide. Yeah, and they use the Kademlia flavor. There are some other DHT algorithms like Cort and Pastry, but this one is widespread. So What questions do we ask? Who stores data? Someone has to. Preferably not central service. So everyone stores data. It's peer-to-peer. And how to interact with data that's related. We don't want to store all IP addresses of DHT nodes because that wouldn't scale. The BitTorrent DHT is about 5 million nodes, and the figure is from a year ago. But not all are reachable. Reachable are like 30,000 that are not behind network address translations, translation or firewall. So you don't want to store all the addresses, and therefore you ask your way through the known nodes, the nodes that are known to you. Yeah, it's again 160 bit, 20 bytes, which is exactly the info hash length. And the protocol is quite simple. It's this previously explained B encoding just in UDP packets. There are four operations. And these operations have kind of like RPC semantics. There are clients that may care about timeouts and retrying. So, as a reminder, everywhere 160 bit, conveniently, torrent info hash, DHT node ID, and quite unrelated and not really relevant for this talk is the client peer ID, which could be used to collect version statistics, which is pretty nice, or pretty useful. So we got this 160-bit space, and we need to define how the node nearest to the info hash stores, or what node nearest to the info hash stores the tracker data for the torrent file or info hash. Therefore, we need to introduce a distance metric. This is and this is specific to Kademlia, XOR, bitwise exclusive OR, and the nice property is that it's a reflexive operation. Therefore, you don't need. It's really convenient to use. These. This is a tad simplified, but in general it works like this. And all the node IDs that one node deals with are relative to the own node ID. And because we do this over distance.
I'm sorry. Could you please speak closer to the microphone?
Isn't this the microphone?
Oh, it's the feed. Oh, I get it.
Don't you understand me? I'm very sorry.
Oh, should we use this one? They were saying there's some feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Should we change anything? No? Okay, sorry, I'm really sorry.
Yeah. Okay, the important thing here with this bucket routing is that the closer one node, or the closer a node ID is to another node ID, the less probable this is. Because imagine this is the key space and all the DHT nodes are equally distributed over the key space. So I store eight peers in bucket zero. Oh, Yeah, one is actually bucket zero and two is actually bucket one and so forth. And this representation should clarify that it's less probable to have a neighbor that is like in bucket 8 or even a higher bucket. So there are lots of DHT nodes that are eligible to get into bucket 0, but there are many less to get into bucket 8 because they are nearer to a client's own node ID. Don't let the word buckets confuse you. It's just 8 times the node ID, IP address, and port. That's it. So the interesting request, the interesting operation is find node for bootstrapping, finding your place in the DHT, for knitting around holes, and of course to grow the DHT. Specifically to Kademlia is that you not only actively look for other nodes, but of course you also need to accept incoming packets, evaluate the node ID if it's really if it could be a new neighbor. And this allows new nodes at all. The request ID is for request response association for the RPC semantics. And the really interesting thing is that with each find node packet, we get the sender's node ID. And this one is useful for a popularity contest. We don't want to wait for our node ID to become more widespread known in the DHT. It could take a long time. We want to become popular quick. And because the nearest node ID is least probable, we have good a high probability to become a valid neighbor, to become known to as many nodes as possible to get into their routing buckets. The find node request responses also contain these node IDs, precious node IDs, where we can flip some of the least significant bits and become a neighboring node ID. And this is what the title Lines and Neighbors is about. So this is a test. You can see the four packet types, and what the test does is it regularly contacts peers with their own node ID, but with some of the less significant bits flipped, and it seems to be an exponential growth. I think from minute 15 on, it's CPU or I/O bound. And exponential because the other nodes will gossip among each other what are suitable nodes in their keyspace neighborhood. Find node requests is 92 bytes. Responses, the packets that we sent, are 208 bytes. And this is really not a good ratio, but the exponential growth means once started, it will develop itself and get big. Maybe the total packet rate is much higher than 14,000 packets. I didn't... Well, computers have limits. How do we use that popularity? We ourselves get a find node request, as you can see here. And of course, we can respond with 8 node IDs and addresses and ports. And this is a test where I put 8 UDP ports into those find node responses. And the impact is, in terms of the packet rate, quite higher than the traffic we have. So this is traffic at the target. Yes, packets are again being encoded requests to arbitrary addresses. And on a network level, what is critical are stateful firewalls, because this is from random internet hosts, and stateful firewalls may create one entry per packet and will quickly have their tables filled. Also, network interface card drivers are quite prone to collapsing over high packet rates. On the application level, this only affects poor parsers. Because my proposition is UDP parsers are much more efficient than TCP parsers because the packet boundary is already known. Also, TCP requires quite some state keeping in the operating system. So this one has been done before with trackers. Anyone who controls a popular tracker has incredible power to DDoS. Can we do the same here? So what we need is sock puppets. And these are the cheap replicas of meaningful nodes, or as in the so-called Zibble attack, it's forging identities in P2P networks. Zibble is named after a woman with a multiple personality disorder. So remember, the node ID is random or arbitrary, and we don't want to fetch like 500 torrent files. So the really nice thing at a lot of BitTorrent indexes is you can sort by seeders and leeches, and if you do that for normal BitTorrent usage, you will have high download rates. And Pirate Bay, for instance, offers magnet links directly in the listing. So we can just scrape that information from the web page and use node IDs, popular node IDs. This gets a much more controlled approach than the first attack. This, for example, is the DHT traffic for a node that has communicated with other DHT nodes as the 267 most leached torrents on Pirate Bay. And what's interesting here is that we still have contrary to the previous attack, a fairly low rate of find node requests, but the get peers for the tracker data itself is accelerating much more. And what can we do with get peers requests? We can respond with deterrent peer addresses, IP address and port. And the clients that queried me will try to establish a connection there. Get peers requests are 95 bytes. Responses are 65 plus 6 bytes per address we pass. So it's fairly low weight. And the impact looked like this. Excuse my testing methodology. I wanted to keep my Amazon EC2 bill low. This graph has its traffic at the target, and each curve represents a port that was used 1, 2, or 4 times in the get peers response. The packet rate isn't that impressive, but it's still hard to filter this. These connections coming from random IP addresses. And note the tail. There are many implementations, some cache peer addresses longer, some have duplicate detection by port or by IP. And I think the reason for this decline after half an hour is that the tracker tracker request get nodes interval is 1,800 seconds, but clients may implement this differently. So, what's the traffic that's resulting in this? A TCP connection with the BitTorrent protocol handshake, which is 38 bytes. Or a bit bigger if message stream encryption is enabled. So, the really critical part for the target is whatever services are running there, they need efficient parsers, parsers that terminate early if they detect protocol violations for their actual service. One serious victim is SSL. And the general advice is either do your parsing on all ends right, or use tools like parser generators or combinators. So does this mean you should panic and turn off the DHT? I don't think so. Not all the nodes are sending all the time. For you as an individual DHT node, it won't matter if you send like one UDP packet each 10 seconds. Well, there are some clients which start to send a lot of packets, but that should be fixed, of course. The DHT is still usable. Trackers are not often. I have really performance problems with trackers. My BitTorrent client starts to hang with these HTTP requests, and DHT just works. So client implementers, as an advice, may start to index their DHT routing information not only by distance but by IP address, and it will get likely that you are able to detect such malicious behavior. And this is many duplicate IPs per many, one IP per many node info hashes. No, per the HT node IDs are clearly a sign for malicious activity and are much more likely than many clients behind network address translation that is properly set up. And clients should not communicate with privileged ports because there are serious services behind that and no peer-to-peer. So is there a way out? I discovered another protocol that uses the Kademlia DHT. It's a telehash by Jeremy Miller. The solution he approached is to not make the node ID random, but to make it a hash that is verifiable. And by using IP address and port, or maybe only IP address, the possible node IDs per IP are reduced drastically. And it's much, much, much less likely that you can hash one of your IP addresses or ports to immediate neighbors or popular info hashes. It seems I recently got notice that this has been proposed for BitTorrent, notably not on BitTorrent.org. The problem, they plan to have a transition period where they start to implement this hashing, still accept random node IDs, so the system doesn't break down. But after some time, I don't know how long they have planned, they will switch to verifying these hashes. The big problem is that malicious people, IPv6, malicious people can probably get big networks where they can have many possible node IDs, while they still want to allow a client with a single IP address to participate in the DHT system. Okay, thanks for listening. Questions?
If you have any questions, just raise your hand. I'll come find you with the mic. Oh, over there. Okay.
Test. Anything about the FIFA DDoS?
What?
Yeah.
Oh. Sorry, there was a question over there.
Anything about the FIFA DDoS we had some months before?
No idea.
Because that was quite the same technique?
It's already known, the problem.
Oh, sorry, okay. What was the answer?
Pardon?
What was the answer?
The problem is already known.
Okay.
So I'm not the only one on this planet.
Anybody else have any questions for him? Hey, well, thank you very much. That was great. Please give him a round of applause.